This is CBS, Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow of the Hoover Institution, teaches law at the University of Chicago and NYU Law School. We turn to the matter of monopoly power, anti-competitiveness, or as the Biden administration characterizes, unfairness. There is an executive order speaking to promoting competition in the American economy. However, before we turn to that and further conversation about a new book that I recommend by Tim Wu, the Columbia president, The Curse of Bigness, because it frames all of this, I'd like Richard's help to understand, as a classical liberal, Richard is a classical liberal, what is the classical liberal position thinking on monopoly power? Good evening to you, Richard.
Yeah, good. Yes, you know, this is a very interesting question. First of all, a classical liberal is somewhat different from a hardline libertarian. A libertarian looks at monopoly, says it's not involving the use of force, it's not involving the use of fraud. If these guys can maintain their position, let them do so. If somebody who's a new entrant comes in and erodes them, that's fine. So the hardline libertarian position is that the permanence of monopoly is always undermined by new entry, so you don't worry about it. The classical liberal is a little bit more skeptical and starts to think that some of these monopolies turn out to be relatively durable, even if it turns out that the state is not propping them up. And so then the question is, what do you do about them? And the general answer is, if it's a monopoly that you can break up in a sensible fashion, you might want to do it. It's even easier when you're dealing with mergers because you don't have all the inefficiencies of taking a big integrated operation and splitting it into multiple parts. You can basically have a merger policy which is designed to protect against high levels of concentration. And that's generally been the focal point of this. And everybody agrees that you can stop them. The question is, what is it that you want to stop and why do you want to stop it? So for somebody who's a classical liberal, there is something known as the Herfindahl-Hirschman Index. And with this says in relatively stable markets, that is, where you don't have massive technological innovations and so forth, the way you gauge market power is what you do is you take the square of the concentration of the biggest firms and then sum those numbers up. It sounds a little bit crazy, but if you have only one firm in a market and it's got 100% of the thing, then its Herfindahl index is at 10,000. If you got two firms, well, all of a sudden it goes way down because now you're taking 50 times 50 is 2,500 plus 2,500, you're down to 5,000. So you can see as new firms come in, it tends to go down relatively quickly. So the standard kind of view today is 3 into 2 is very bad, 2 into 1 is horrific, 4 into 3 ain't so good, 5 into 4 probably don't worry about it. Somebody who's on the other side of this issue, who's not a classical liberal, doesn't think about that at all. They don't think about market concentrations. They tend to think about size, and they tend to think about size because they think it has something to do with a political power. That is a very dubious situation. Recently, I wrote a little essay about a famous piece by George Stigler written in 1971 called The Theory of Economic Regulation, in which George says if you're playing politics, it's always the big guys who win because they can move Congress. When you actually go back and look what's going on in the periods that he was talking about, say the 1930s, more complicated picture. But the first thing is the big guys were constantly being hit, and they've had resort to the court saying your regulation on us is confiscatory if it's rate regulation and so forth. And they really meant that they were being hurt, and the truth about the matter is that oftentimes that was the case. And if you wanted to figure out who could get cartels going for them, it's people who have the votes, not the money. And so it was farmers and laborers in the 1930s who started to do this. Classical liberal, when they start to see the government backing up cartelization by anybody, whether it be laborers or manufacturers, it doesn't really matter, farmers, they're strongly against it. Today we have a very different attitude on this. The new American left basically says, we're not worried about market concentration, we're worried about political size, and they tend to bless and to organize the kinds of cartels that you have with farmers and laborers and so forth and union members. So it's a completely different operation. And so somebody like myself who looks at what the Biden administration is doing comes up with a very naive conclusion. They're just asking for trouble. And what they do in effect is they stop innovation, say a big firm acquiring a little firm. They think that that's a serious concentration issue or there'll be nascent competition. I regard it as a way of getting new firms to start up because one of their options is to go public. But another option that they have in many of these cases is to be bought out by a bigger competitor who can actually merge the technology that they develop with what they have.
Let's speak to that, because that is the major concern of Tim Wu, Professor Tim Wu, special assistant to President Biden. The curse of bigness I mentioned, and to characterize it, according to the publisher, this tells how figures like Brandeis and Theodore Roosevelt, the curse of bigness, first confronted the democratic threats posed by the great trust of the Gilded Age. All right, now, I'll turn to the Supreme Court on this. According to your reporting for me, Richard, because I'm learning from this, that dealing with bigness is a story that's come before the Supreme Court several times. The one that seems immediately applicable to the situation, say, about Facebook buying up smaller competitive firms so that it doesn't have to deal with it in future, is dated from the 1960s, United States versus Vons Grocery Company et al. It was argued in March of 66. It was decided in May of 66. The reason I pay attention to this is that it has to do with one grocery chain in Los Angeles buying another grocery chain, and the argument was that that would be anti-competitive. Here's what in the decision by the court deciding it wasn't anti-competitive, here's what the court does for history background. Like the Sherman Act in 1890 and the Clayton Act in 1914, the basic purpose of the 1950 Seller-Kefauver Act was to prevent economic concentration in the American economy by keeping a large number of small competitors in business. In stating the purposes of their bill, both of its sponsors, Representative Seller and Senator Kefauver, emphasized their fear, widely shared by other members of Congress, that this concentration was rapidly driving the small businessman out of the market. The period from 1940 to 1947, which was at the center of attention throughout the hearings and debates on the Seller-Kefauver bill, had been characterized by a series of mergers between large corporations and their smaller competitors, resulting in the steady erosion of the small independent business in our economy. I'll stop there, because you could take that paragraph, change the words a few, and drop in other companies, and that is the same anxiety we hear expressed today in the 21st century. Now, your measure of how the court decided this and how it speaks to today the concerns of Professor Wu and the Biden administration about bigness.
Well, it's interesting. That case came down just before I entered the Yale Law School. And when I was there, one of my teachers was a man named Ward Bowman, who was the co-author of Robert Bork and many powerful articles in Fortune magazine and the like that were written in exactly that period. And what they did is they sort of looked at the numbers on the size of the two companies involved. They would be trivial by the Herfindahl Index. And so they said the only reason they're doing this is they could actually get some efficiencies out of the situation by combining operations. They may have an ability, for example, to sell the same product in a larger market, so the fixed cost could be spread over a larger number of units, which lowers the average cost to computers. If you look at the statement that's made by Seller and Kefauver, both of whom are kind of populist, one from New York and one from Tennessee, both Democrats, their attitude was there are no efficiencies associated with mergers. And so, therefore, they're just all bad, and stopping them doesn't have any cost. As I mentioned earlier, my view is really quite the difference. It turns out that there are often very important gains that come by putting together firms that have complementary technologies and can perform better as one. And if it turns out that the concentration in the market from the merger is still relatively low, say, you know, going from 8 to 7 or whatever it is, then generally it's something that is socially desirable. The other key feature that you have to understand is what's the rate of new entry of small firms. You could have a static model which looks at small firms and says, gee, they only have 6% of the market. But then what happens is you go 5 years down the road and it turns out some of those small firms become big firms. If you don't encourage the seeds to be planted, you're not going to get the trees a generation later. And so there is a peculiarly static, sterile model associated with the Kefauver-Keller situation, which ignores the fact that, thank heaven, you know, little girls grow bigger every day, and so it is with respect to little firms. So it's saying when you're trying to look at all of this stuff and you're figuring out what's going on, this doesn't seem to make any sense. The other thing is they get the ecology all wrong. Think of the oceans, right? They've got whales and they've got minnows. Why is it that it turns out that you don't only have whales? Well, it's because the small people can enter niches that the larger people can't. So you may have a big bank like Chase or Bank of America, and at the same time, you'll have some little bank which has about 1/100th of the capital, but the guy who's running that bank knows the grocer and the baker, and he can make the small loans that they need in order to expand their kinds of facilities, whereas a large bank like Chase or Bank of America can't possibly reach those kinds of people. And so what happens is if you start to see these markets having a distribution like that, you don't want to think of things as stable. Another way to do this is to take and unpack a very misleading statistic, which says that, there are now 20 firms in the United States in 1960 that have X percent of the market, and you start going to 1970, and that 20% of the firms now have X plus Y of the market. One of the things to remember is that the firms that were powerful in 1960 may not have been powerful in 1970. Largest corporations in the United States in, say, around 2000, something like General Electric. And, you know, these companies are tiny today relative to what they were. And so the level of dynamism is much greater than the simple static figure starts to tell you. And if you see these firms growing and then shrinking and then dying, you realize that what's going on here is that nobody, regardless of size, is safe. So you could recall the Time Warner American Online, right? AOL merger.
Of course.
Everybody says it was AOL that was taking over Time Warner. In 10 years, AOL was a, you know, a stub company. It wasn't worth much of anything. And when they broke up, all the value turned out to be on the other side. So if you're looking at these sorts of things, don't take snapshots. Try to project something going on into the future. And what you will start to find is that so long as entry barriers are kept low, the dynamism, particularly in rapidly moving technological areas, is much more important than any measure that you have. So even if you have a high Herfindahl concentration in the industry, if it's a dynamic industry, it means less than it does if you're dealing with a kind of public utility where you really can't expect there's going to be a lot of entry into the electricity or the pipeline market and so forth. These are large projects that tend to move relatively slowly. So your antitrust lens will look very differently depending upon the configuration of the firm.
I'm speaking with Professor Richard Epstein, a senior fellow of the Hoover Institution, teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago. We're speaking in general about the Biden administration's concerns for unfairness and bigness in a presidential order, speaking to how it is necessary to examine large successful corporations here in 2021 and to mitigate what is presumed to be the unfairness of the marketplace. When we come back, we're going to turn to another Supreme Court case that seems to illustrate bigness and anti-competitive pricing concerns from the 1980s, Matsushita versus Zenith Ratio Corporation. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.